Thanks again to Laj for inviting me to talk in this session. And I've learned a lot already in this session attending this morning, and I was particularly grateful for some of the comments made about understanding things in space and time. And I think you'll get a little bit more of that from the standpoint of what Jerry Hatfield was talking about this morning. I've been fortunate to be a part of a project called Climate Friendly Farming. And this was funded through the Paul Allen Charitable Foundation and out in the Pacific Northwest. And there's quite a team that's been brought together 6 years ago, starting 6 years ago, to try to look at what does it mean to be a climate-friendly farm. And I have to thank my co-authors, particularly Claudio Stacco, a modeler at WSU, Armin Kamanian, who used to be at WSU and now is going to Penn State. He's back in the audience over there. You can bug him a little bit. Tabitha Brown, a graduate student with me, and Stuart Higgins, who's also helped out quite a bit. I also mentioned that my statements today, that we've talked quite a bit from the standpoint of some lively conversations between these people, and much of my statements today reflect those conversations, but they may not reflect what my co-authors might think, so you'll have to take a little bit of liberty there. This is the team that was put together. I'm in charge of the dryland cropping systems, loosely in charge, and you can see Dr. Hal Collins from the irrigated standpoint. But, you know, this project blends together a lot of people, not just the biophysical scientists and the modeling aspects of things, but also from the economic perspectives and bringing those kinds of people together. And it was this effort that actually resulted in an international award from CSRES, now NIFA, in terms of innovative partnership of teams from the standpoint of putting together this type of effort. So I'm pretty grateful to be part of this whole project that's been ongoing. Some of the mitigation strategies can be put simply into reduce, remove, and replace in terms of greenhouse gas emissions and some of the things that we can do. I'm going to be talking mostly today about some of our efforts with carbon sequestration as well as nitrous oxide reductions, mostly through increasing nitrogen use efficiency through precision ag kinds of applications. So first, carbon. These are some of the agroclimatic zones of the Pacific Northwest, and we wanted to know, well, where have people studied carbon? And this, the little dots that you see on the picture there represent some of the different studies that have been ongoing over the last 100 years or so. There's about 170 studies. Most of them, as you see that cluster of dots, have been right around the land-grant institutions. That's Washington State and the University of Idaho, and they kind of get less dispersed as you move from there. Also, you notice a cluster over there in Oregon around the Pendleton site. So this kind of gives you an idea of not only where the studies have taken place, but also what kinds of climatic zones. And I won't go into these different climatic zones, but from that standpoint, it's looking at placing the data into a context that is important from the standpoint of not only the modeling, but also the growers in terms of how they can take this information and apply it to situations that they may have in their areas. So this is some of the estimated change in soil organic carbon with a shift from conventional tillage to no-till. There was about 11 different studies that we could identify in zone 2. You can see the agroclimatic zone on the left here. 2 and 3 is were actually the only zones that we could find enough, we thought, and even that was bare bones, enough data to try to make some sense of what might be happening there. And you can see the profile changes in SOC content and in terms of micrograms of carbon per hectare per year. About the average coming in at about 0.71 in zone 2, but look at the standard deviation. And then also the units in trading. This is always a confusing thing, metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per acre per year. Okay, now there's a tradable unit, and again, we get into whole unit kinds of messes. And we've been called to the carpet by farmers when we didn't present the right kinds of units to them. So I'm being a little bit more careful from that standpoint. So if we could put that, of course, on a cumulative probability function, there's zone 2 in terms of the black being the data. And if you assume a normal probability distribution, this is the expected values that you might have, the white lines. There's zone 2 and zone 3. And you notice there's quite a range there. And if you look at the literature, of course, we tend in our dryland areas to be supposedly near around, well, if you look at Mark Liebig's, some of his of estimations, about maybe 0.35 or so in terms of megagrams of carbon sequestered per hectare per year over the course of your time scale is important too, about 10 years or so. But you can see a lot of other data that's up above one. And thank you. And in fact, some of the discussions that we have with the modeling effort is, well, is that even feasible to have those kinds of high results in terms of being part of the collected data that you're using to calibrate and validate your models with? So from that standpoint, and going through a number of exercises, some of these values that are above one are probably unrealistic, and you start thinking about what kinds of sampling issues and problems that these scientists had in terms of actually collecting realistic soil organic carbon data. And I might talk a little bit about that some more, but that's certainly a large question that you have in terms of the data itself. Here's some of the calibration that work that and corroboration work that Claudia's run with the CropCyst simulation on Pendleton data. In the Pacific Northwest, we're not blessed with a lot of long-term studies where we can actually calibrate and corroborate models with. And so this is a real issue, really. And this is some of the highest quality data that we have from the standpoint of looking at the long-term trends in measured carbon values and that we can use to help to calibrate and corroborate a model out there. After looking at this with Claudio, I said, well, I could have done that with two parameters. But anyway, there's some nice looking sloping lines there in terms of the data. And the model seems to be working fairly well there. Again, this is the CropCyst simulation. And some of the results from the modeling effort, and I'll just break these out, are for soil organic carbon. And we've added the residue carbon as well. This is for the change and going, shifting from a conventional tillage situation to no-till. And the Lind and St. John and Pullman, that's the LND and St. John on the x-axis, those are locations, and they tend to go from low precipitation areas, less than 14 inches, and then St. John, intermediate area, and then Pullman, where we are, it's more of an annual cropping in a high rainfall area. So you can keep that in mind. And then in Pullman, there's several different options there. Those represent either reduced tillage or no-till. And then B is continuous cereals, and P has a pulse or a legume in the rotation. But anyway, the upshot of all of this is that the model is coming in on the lower side of things. And this is megatons of carbon dioxide equivalent per acre per year. Again, more of a farm and a trading issue. And I just wanted to put those on our cumulative probability plot in terms of where they ended up. And you can see the CropCyst modeled efforts for both the no-till zone 2 and in zone 3. As well, and you can see it's kind of coming in more in the middle of this cluster of points that's on the lower end of things from the standpoint of this probability distribution. And I think, you know, the take-home message with some of this is that this is the kinds of data that I like to present when I'm looking at the uncertainty involved with not only the measurement but the modeling as well. And as a scientist, I feel if I can develop some of these cumulative probability curves, these are the kinds of data that I can show to policymakers and others, and they can decide how certain or uncertain they want to be, and or conservative or liberal in terms of interpreting these kinds of data. Oops. I'm pushing the wrong button now. Thanks. Uh-oh, it's not going. Okay, so now let's add some complexity, as Jerry Hatfield was talking about this morning. This is the actual landscape that we're looking at. Oops, now I'm going too fast. This is the actual landscape that we're looking at, and you can see there's quite a bit of complexity involved, and much of this is derived from not only the lust that blew into this area and created these sand dune-like kinds of topographic formations that add a lot of beauty to the area, but also an extreme amount of complexity. And landscape processes often become extremely important in terms of trying to understand issues like soil organic carbon. And some of those landscape processes, of course, are soil erosion. And how many people here have talked about, okay, since the advent of agriculture, we've reduced soil organic matter by about 50%. Who would say that? That's coming in true for a lot of areas. And it certainly is true for much of the upland positions that we have here, perhaps even more than that. But if you get down to the bottom slopes here, where there's been quite a bit of deposition, we actually have a lot more carbon there than we had under native conditions. In fact, we have probably 1.5 times in some cases more carbon than we have during native conditions. So these redistribution processes of soil organic carbon following landscape kinds of of activities, in this case soil erosion, have really changed the where the carbon is, how it's been moved around the landscape, and its variability in space and in time itself. And in fact, if you're looking at carbon input models based on just biological inputs of carbon from the standpoint of plants, et cetera, and you get a linear relationship between that and how much soil organic carbon that you might get, well, this is completely disconnected from the standpoint of that model, because now we've got a physical process involved that's really changed the amount of carbon in these landscapes and where it's situated. And so if you look at the WSU Cook Agronomy Farm, here's soil organic carbon. We measured down to 1.5 meters, and you find a range in carbon levels from 53 to 275 megagrams of carbon per hectare. So even though we've been discussing these differences in 0.1 and 0.2 megagrams per hectare that in terms of the change that might be happening, this is the landscape that we're trying to apply some of those numbers to. And is it really adequate from the standpoint of the numbers that we're talking about to do that? And to try to look then, when I change a certain management like conventional tillage to no-till, am I really going to reflect the actual changes that are taking place on this type of scenario? So I'm going to switch over to nitrous oxide now. Here's estimates of emissions in terms of equivalencies, again, per acre for those Lynn, St. John areas. And also not only a 12-year, but a 30-year prognosis, as well as the IPCC measurements. Thank you. And 30-year. And you can see the IPCC values are quite a bit larger than what the crop cyst levels are coming in at. But then again, looking at the actual values, they look fairly reasonable. They tend to be on what you would think slow, like maybe 0.8 to 1 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year in terms of losses. But if you actually look at the significance of this and put it in the standpoint of not just the carbon sequestration but the nitrous oxide losses, then you start looking at net CO2 equivalences, considering both of those, and you see some negative values coming in there as well as some positive ones in terms of what we're actually accomplishing with different kinds of management scenarios. In this case, the modeled results for tillage really didn't show us much differences in terms of nitrous oxide losses, and you can argue whether that's true or not. But it was clear to me, looking at these kinds of data, that and it's clear to others as well, that improving nitrogen use efficiency is going to be a real key from the standpoint of climate-friendly farming and what that might look like. And this really drove us from the standpoint of looking at more precision nitrogen application effects. So, you know, precision agriculture looks pretty intuitively attractive on these kinds of landscapes, and it comes down, of course, to prediction and how well we can predict and the uncertainty of those predictions. And certainly some of the modeling efforts can help us with this. This is water recharge. We're in a winter precipitation pattern. We got about 400 millimeters this winter, and this is how much of it we could find out there in the spring. And you notice the recharge is 40 to 120% and 64% on the field average. So of course we can measure the incoming precipitation, but its relationship to what we actually find in the soil at the end of the recharge period is almost zero from the standpoint of because of the redistribution processes involved. And of course, snow redistribution is involved with this. Infiltration and then lateral transport in the soil itself is another important mechanism. And these patterns tend to be guided mostly by soil and topographic properties, but they do change from year to year, as well as the percentages ranging from maybe 40%, this is 64%, we find an average. We can find years that are only 50% and other years that are 70%. And you can see the patterns of relative yield are similar from the standpoint of this 37-hectare field. These data are generated with 369 deer reference points that are scattered about this 37-hectare field, about a point every 30 meters or so. And you can see that there's some, in this case, some real patterns that look very, very similar. And to put these together, we've tried to look at time and site-specific information, historic data from standpoint of yield and protein, some of the GPS survey, remote and ground sensing and sampling, and two kinds of strategies here, using empirical models, traditional to a lot of field scientists, but also process-oriented models to try to look at some of these temporally fixed as well as temporally variable attributes to put them together in terms of distributed conditional probabilities of yield or nitrogen demand or supply, and then in turn see if those uncertainties are low enough that we can actually do something. We can be predictive enough to do some precision nitrogen management. If the uncertainty, of course, is too large, then you're back to uniform applications of nitrogen. So these are considerations. Emphasize landscape, farm scale decisions. If we're going to help farmers, we need to be operating in terms of the modeling on their scale. And engage, we have to engage them at that process level, at that field level. And believe me, if you work with farmers, your perspectives will change in terms of what needs to be modeled and how you might model it and how you might express those models. And evaluating the uncertainty. Not only the model and biophysical factors, but also economic factors need to be integrated within this. So thanks again. There is a website that I show, and I really appreciate being part of this symposium today. Thank you.